KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. A jury over the weekend found George Zimmerman not guilty of murder in the shooting of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. What does that trial say about race in America? We're going to talk with Seattle Times columnist Jerry Large coming up this hour. August 6th is Election Day. Seattle voters will be choosing between 9 candidates for mayor. Among them is Joey Gray. Gray is a librarian and a consultant for nonprofits across the Puget Sound region. She's an accomplished athlete and an advocate for sports. She's the co-founder of Seattle Public Schools' after-school Ultimate Frisbee program, the first such co-ed program in the nation. She serves on the boards of the Cascade Bicycle Club, Friends of Athletic Fields, and other nonprofits. She lives on a houseboat, and she enjoys gardening in her spare time. She joins me today in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Marcy. It's great to be here.
Thanks. So, Joey, we are asking all 9 candidates the same series of questions with some wild cards, so we're just going to jump right in. The Department of Justice has a consent agreement to undertake steps to curtail the unconstitutional use of excessive force by Seattle Police Department. A federal judge is monitoring the city's project. What do you think of the steps taken by the city so far to fix the problem?
One of the most important things about this huge problem our city's facing, and it's not just Seattle. The relationship between the police departments, the city, and citizens is stressed across the country. So recognizing that, the most important thing to me is to build a culture of respect between all city staff and all citizens. And I've actually been out to the Occupy protests myself, and I've seen things that are questionable in my view as a citizen. And at the same time, I have great respect for all of our public servants and their professionalism and the things they face every day.
So what would be the first step that you would take as mayor?
The very, very first thing I would do would be to thank all of our public servants. I would thank the police for their hard work, and I would encourage all citizens to step up to fiercely fight for civil liberties as well.
There are plans for coal terminals to be built in Washington state to handle coal from Wyoming bound for China and other Asian nations. Many environmentalists oppose the new coal terminals. Some union workers say that they're in favor because it would make jobs. What do you believe?
I'm absolutely against coal trains coming through here. We already have them. We can't take any more. I've been working with environmental groups, building their databases, strategic planning for many environmental groups that have been fighting that. We've had thousands and thousands of people up and down Puget Sound at hearings. We need to, as government leaders, we need to provide other kinds of jobs. If fossil fuel export is our jobs program, we need to think outside that box and do something different.
What do you think the city of Seattle should do first to improve the transportation system?
We need an integrated approach. We've got so much expertise and a wealth of plans, from the bike plan, the pedestrian plan, the transit plan. And that work is at a super high level already. We just need better integration. We need to think about, instead of modes, we need to really get past the war on whatever and think about time. Think about how fast we can get from one corner of the city to another and make those choices available, more and more choices available to everybody.
A lot of the development that's going on in Seattle's neighborhoods is transit dependent. We're trying to move density into certain parts of our city. How do you see the transportation planning and the neighborhood planning overlapping?
Those two things are totally integrated, because we can't build density in places that aren't well served by transit, because we don't have the space for all the car parking, or we need to build up for car parking. We have a really great innovation here in Seattle, the walk score and the bike score folks, and those kinds of information systems really help citizens navigate a changing transportation environment. And as mayor, I would facilitate more communication between citizen-driven initiatives like that with our tech-rich expertise here, and apply city resources to those problems.
And just one last question on that topic. A lot of neighborhood councils have done some planning for density in their neighborhoods. What role do you think that those citizens groups have in the city planning processes?
Citizens groups need to not only be invited to speak, but they need to have power within the system. They need to preserve that planning, and they need to have some sense of equality between all those citizen efforts and the corporate-driven density that is happening here. Now, I was in favor of density back in the 90s when we voted on that. I completely agree with the argument that we need to have less sprawl and less driving. At the same time, citizens need to be actively involved in a powerful way from the get-go.
We're talking with Joey Gray. She's running for mayor of the city of Seattle. Recently, the mayor and Seattle City Council decided to shut down the homeless camp that's known as Nicholsville and trying to find housing for the residents. Do you support that decision, and what should be done about homelessness?
Homelessness, again, is a big problem nationwide, and we have a pretty fractured approach to solving it here. We've let pretty underfunded nonprofits take up the slack with really hardworking staff and caring people do the work of government, because we haven't been willing to fund government, excellent government programs that serve the great, great need. We have neighbors feeling threatened and confused about what's happening in their neighborhoods and not being able to control the use of space there. And we really need to have a diverse approach. We can't just have one size fits all. There's a lot of stereotypes about the homeless out there, and those characters who fit those stereotypes are just a very small part of the story. We need to focus more on car camping, get people out of their cars and into more stable housing.
Do you support the city's decision to shut down Nicholsville for good?
Nicholsville itself is a temporary solution. At the same time, I've been there. I know people who have helped there. We need a place for families. The way that it was done was really unfair. They found out their home was going to be disrupted from the media showing up. That shows a profound lack of respect. I feel like, well, I actually believe strongly that tent cities are a part of the solution, even though they're temporary, and we need to support them in diverse ways.
How do you rate the job that Mike McGinn has been doing as mayor?
I've declined to speak on the performance of the current mayor or any of the other candidates, because my race is about me, and I feel like I'm the best candidate that we have because of my executive experience, my commitment to environmental activism, my systems approach to leadership, and international diplomatic experience.
What international diplomatic experience do you have?
I served as an executive committee member of the World Flying Disc Federation simultaneously and after having served as the executive director of a national governing body for sport. In doing that, I traveled all over the world representing the United States and the sport of ultimate frisbee, disc golf, and freestyle, and set up world championships and the world games under the patronage of the International Olympic Committee.
You've done that work. You've also done a lot of, as we've talked about, a lot of community service work on various nonprofit boards, volunteering. How does that translate into work at City Hall as an executive?
I actually need to correct the introduction. I don't sit on any boards right now.
Okay.
I have sat on the boards of the Cascade Bicycle Club, Friends of Athletic Fields. I founded Disc Northwest and sat on the board and served as executive director and president there. My ability to work in many, many different nonprofit, for-profit, government, and education environments means I can come in and out of different departments, different organizations, and different community groups, understand really quickly what their needs are, what the core issues are, bring people together to solve intractable problems, and to have fun doing it.
What prompted you to put your hat into the race?
You know, as a consultant, I've worked on a lot of public information campaigns and advocacy, and I love helping others do that. And I started to realize that I could and would do things a little bit differently than some of the campaigns I've worked on. I worked really hard on the Protect Seattle Now, which was to help stop the deep bore highway tunnel. And there were a lot of things about that campaign that I would have liked to see done differently.
Like what?
Well, I would have liked to win.
All right.
I would have liked to stop the tunnel. I would have liked to have that set up in a way that could win and that was tenacious enough to do it.
Well, so that's outcome-based. How would you have approached the campaign differently if you had been the person running it in charge of it?
You know, there's a lot of detail there that your question really was about how my experience working with nonprofits and different groups is enabling me to be the best next mayor for Seattle. And one thing I learned in that campaign was that it was way more divisive than it needed to be. And I experienced that personally and among my friends. And there's a way to do the right thing in the right way at the right time. And I've got that skill.
What do you see as the first priority if you are elected mayor?
I've been asked that a couple times, and my main themes are equality for all the time, and we've seen nationally this week exactly how important that is. Secondly, good governance in general in order to facilitate all the other important needs and desires and issues that everybody has for the city. The important thing is that behind the scenes, so much work is done on, say, information systems that help prevent the problems. We don't have to focus on crisis for political purposes. I'm just totally oriented towards prevention. And thirdly, climate change is by far the most important humanitarian crisis our world is facing. And we are doing a lot here in Seattle. We have so many experts, so many academics, so many consultants, so many community activists, and they're not coordinated well enough to fight back in the way that we need. And with information system skills that I have, I can do that.
It's one of your things that you've learned because you are, they don't call them librarians anymore, aren't you? An information technologist, isn't that the term?
Library and information science is such an amazing field because you can do so many different things. And I ended up using that as an executive leadership skill, and I could project manage volunteer and paid techies in ways that were really innovative.
And just a last question. Some political observers have spoken on this program about how we have 9 candidates, most of whom share many of the same progressive values. What distinguishes Joey Gray from the other 8?
I have a great balance of political insider experience, meaning that my first job was with the Washington State Senate back as a page. I have interned in Congress, and I've helped a lot of political and advocacy groups, and like I said, been involved in a lot of different organizing activities, including fighting against the tar sands. But the thing that I've been able to do is, as a non-politician, combine that awareness with a complete freedom to say what needs to be said when it needs to be said. I'm not beholden to any special interests. I understand how things work, and I have a unique balance of experience and freedom.
Joey Gray is one of 9 candidates running for mayor of Seattle. The ballots go out in the mail this week. The official date to have them returned is August 6th, what we used to call Election Day. We're talking with all of the candidates this week on Weekday and The Conversation. And those interviews are going to be archived at our website, kuow.org. Tomorrow, Kate Martin and Douglas McQuaid will be in our studios. Joey Gray, thank you very much.
Thank you, too.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
And today, during the noon hour, an interview with incumbent Mayor Mike McGinn. It's 10:20. George Zimmerman's not guilty verdict and the issue of race in America in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Gilbert and Sullivan Society, presenting The Gondoliers, or The King of Barataria, where 3 wives each acquire 2/3 of a husband. The real king will be revealed. July 12th through the 27th at Bagley Wright Theater. Tickets at brownpapertickets.com.
Another hot, sunny day coming our way. Currently 69 degrees and sunny. The forecast says it's going to get up into the 80s today. Then tomorrow, sunny again with a high of 87. 10:21, I'm Bernard Ouellette. The 3 interfaith amigos are a pastor, a rabbi, and an imam. They'll join us with some thoughts on their 13 years of interfaith dialogue just a bit later this hour.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Over the weekend, a Florida jury acquitted George Zimmerman of second-degree murder and a lesser charge of manslaughter in the shooting of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Protests erupted around the country following that verdict, including a rally of at least 400 people last evening in Seattle's Westlake Park. Protesters are calling for justice for Martin, and now the NAACP is circulating a petition to the Department of Justice to open a civil rights case against George Zimmerman. The incident and the subsequent trial touched a nerve with the American public, and it ignited again a debate about race relations in America. What does this trial say about race in America? Joining us now is Jerry Large, a Seattle Times columnist. He wrote about the Zimmerman trial, and he joins us now to talk a little bit more broadly about the results of this verdict and what impact it might have. Jerry Large, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Marcy.
First off, were you surprised at the verdict?
I wasn't surprised. I was disappointed, but not surprised. The Florida law that the case was tried under gives a person great latitude for claiming that that they felt some sort of threat to themselves, that law, which has been adopted by more than 20 other states since Florida adopted it in 2005, is an invitation for this kind of thing.
You said in an earlier column that it wasn't just George Zimmerman on trial, but that it was inequality on trial. What do you mean?
Well, inequality on trial because different people, I think, would have been viewed differently by George Zimmerman. I mean, the sort of undercurrent of that trial was his view of Trayvon Martin as a potentially dangerous person, as a person who was up to no good, simply by looking at him walking through this community. Whether he would have made that judgment if Trayvon Martin hadn't been a young black man, a young teenager, in fact, that's something that has been part of a debate in this country for a long time, and I don't think it's really something that should be a debate at this point. We have a lot of information which shows the disparate ways in which black men are seen in all kinds of contexts. This trial just put it front and center.
You know, we talk a lot about how to legislate equality and the kinds of laws that would help foster it, but it's one thing to talk about statistics and numbers and access to jobs and education. You can't really legislate people's attitudes.
No, you can't. You have to educate. And we don't do a very good job of that either. I think you recall the case in Seattle at the center school where they had a class on where blunt, honest discussions of race were being taking place, and that class was shut down. I mean, there's some the circumstances surrounding it are not entirely clear because so little information was given out by the district when it made that decision. But we always have a difficult time talking about issues that involve race. And if we don't get past that, then we never get to the point of having enough broad understanding to change the dynamics.
The verdict comes this summer very shortly after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. What connection do you see between these two?
Well, I think that for a lot of the country, the idea that there is still bias against black people feels wrong because we have a black president and we're supposed to be post-racial. But even before that, I think there was in the aftermath of the civil rights movement and the gains of that movement, almost immediately after that, there began to be a backlash against things like affirmative action, a sense that we were going too far in trying to make things right. And today, I think it's a sense on a lot of people's part that there is not a problem, and that allows for some things like the Supreme Court ruling.
We're talking with Seattle Times columnist Jerry Large about the aftermath of the verdict of not guilty in the George Zimmerman trial. The NAACP is circulating a petition asking the Department of Justice to open a civil case against George Zimmerman. Do you think that that would have a positive impact on race relations, or is it more a matter of trying to get justice?
I think that's more a matter of trying to get justice, and the from what I've heard, the department is going to go ahead with its investigation. It would be very hard to prove that he had racist intent. That's always a difficult thing to prove because you can't get inside someone's head, and unless they specifically say something, that's a very difficult case to prove. But it says to people who are upset that the Justice Department is at least willing to push further into this, that we shouldn't give up entirely on the idea of there being justice in the case.
This verdict came down Pacific time Saturday afternoon. Yesterday, we saw rallies of various sizes across the country, including a significant rally of several hundred people in Westlake Park in Seattle yesterday evening. And it got me to thinking back to 1967, which is, the middle of the civil rights era, and the kinds of mass protests that we saw through the 60s throughout America. Do you see any comparisons between then and now?
I don't think, every era has its own strategies, and I'm not sure that is going to be the strategy that makes the difference for us today. Things are very, very different then. But I think it's important for people to go to the street and make their voices heard. It's a way of calling attention to a problem, but ultimately the problem has to be solved by better education, more equality in a variety of areas, but I don't see that as being the major mover or even the laws. I mean, some laws do need to be changed, like that self-defense law in Florida, but we've changed laws without changing people's ideas about other people, about race, and even electing a black president. I mean, since 2008, I think Pew and some of the other surveying companies have found that there's been a growth in negative attitudes about black Americans within the country, which is a sort of fascinating thing. Somehow we have to get at those things through a change in how we in media deal with race, how education deals with race. We have a lot of work to do, and it's great for people to call attention to that in the street. That's necessary, but it's got to also happen in offices and schoolrooms.
You mentioned the center school teacher who was transferred for having a class that did focus on very open conversations about race relations. From listening to you, I get the sense that you're talking about opening multifaceted conversations in all sorts of venues, whether it be schools or community centers. What's the first step in your mind, or what should we do immediately?
I think it's important to have better coverage of racial issues in all media. I don't know. We had, there was a lot of bumbling around about whether George Zimmerman was white or Hispanic, for instance, I think most media sort of settled on saying that he identified himself as a white Hispanic, without addressing the question of why would we assume that being Hispanic would mean that he could not have this particular bias. People of another color can have a bias against somebody else of another color, but we don't have a nuanced representation of race, and that would be a good place to start. The other would be having teachers understand race. Some do, some don't, and that's a function partly of what's taught in classrooms at the university level for people who are going into that field. Those are a couple of small starting places.
Jerry Large, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us.
Thank you, Marcy. I appreciate the opportunity.
Jerry Large is a Seattle Times columnist. I'm Marcy Silman. This is KUOW. Maybe youth is not wasted on the young. Maybe growing old has its own deep and rich rewards. Wendy Lusbader wrote Life Gets Better, The Unexpected Pleasures of Growing Old. She spoke with KUOW's Steve Scherr. He asked her about loving old age and a phrase at the end of the book that she wrote, Memento Mori.
Remember, we must die.
Which I that would be morbid. Some people say, well, that's morbid to think about that.
Well, actually, it makes you more vivacious. It makes you want to live as well as you can to grab hold of life. And as we get older, we become more convinced that someday it's going to be over. And that makes you say to yourself, if not now, then when? And you live better.
So what prompted this thinking? Your own getting older?
I've been working with elders for about 30 years, and some of the most alive and vivacious people I've met have been elders. So for years, I've been thinking, wait a minute, this is the reverse of what we learn culturally. We learn from the society, getting older is lousy. There's nothing to look forward to. But elders themselves have been showing me that there's tremendous action in later life, inwardly. See, that's the problem. We look at the body and we get all confused.
We think that we feel the aches and pains.
Yeah.
We can't walk anymore.
We think it's all deterioration. But inside, there's so much development going on. We become ourselves more and more.
Now, what do you mean that we become ourselves? Wasn't I myself when I was 30 and I'd finally stopped being an adolescent?
Yeah, you know, the 30s is when you really start to grow, because it's in the 30s you finally begin to know who you are. And that process of knowing who you are just keeps increasing with each decade. And it's not easy to stop comparing yourself to other people, to relax into your own identity. We waste so much time comparing ourselves to others.
Tell me about your yoga class that you attended.
Well, in the book, I describe taking yoga in my early 50s, and I was just so awkward. I couldn't bend into really almost any of the positions everyone else was doing. And it's amazing. I felt humiliated and really embarrassed. And then finally, I said to myself, heck, this is the body I have, and this is all it's going to do. And I get up, and I get all these pillows and supports. And then all these other people got up and got pillows and supports. And one person said in the class, I couldn't have taken this class without you because, you know, you're so much worse off than I am. But, you know, that's self-acceptance when you realize, okay, you know, I'm a flawed human being and I'm going to do my best. And let's say I face a situation that in the past would have made me very nervous, like being on the radio. Now I reach into myself and I think, well, what's really important here? What's important is to speak my heart. And I've learned what's important. So now I can say, I'm going to let go of the petty thing that, you know, I want to do well or, you know, something like that. And now I'm interested in what really matters. You just learn what's important. And in learning what's important, you're not as caught up in the smaller things. And that makes your life so much better.
Wendy Lusbader's book is Life Gets Better, The Unexpected Pleasures of Growing Older. So how is this different than in America among the wealthier? How is this different than the way we think about retirement? What you're talking about here, this idea of pleasures of growing old.
Yeah. Retirement is actually a thorny idea. First of all, most people don't do well in retirement who do nothing for anyone else but just pursue their own pleasures, regardless of social class. You know, the ability to retire has everything to do with how much money you have. But now I'm speaking about kind of the spiritual level. We all need to be connected to other human beings. And people who lose that connection when they retire tend to involute and get kind of down.
But the pleasure you're finding is the pleasure that comes with abandoning your editor, abandoning the critic, and instead finding the whatever gave you joy as a child. You talked about a man who had a stroke, a physicist who had a stroke, ends up in the adult daycare.
Yes.
And he's supposed to paint, and he says, "I'm not going to paint." Yes. He was mad. He was mad that he was afflicted. He was mad that he was he could not do what he could do before.
Exactly, and that's very real. And what's so striking is sitting there, even feeling rejection towards the other people at the table who had a variety of ailments. He just, out of that sort of nothingness of sitting there, picked up, you know, a color and put it on the page and just sort of plunged into art and actually became one of the best artists there. And it was a totally unexpected skill. There is a process. You have to pass through certain kinds of disappointments and certain kinds of grieving in order to move into the next phase. It's not that it's just a linear path towards more satisfaction. I think we go through transformation. So I made a whole section called Transformation. And you just described someone being transformed by his stroke. So he had to let go of what he thought his life was about. And then he discovered something else.
Well, you know, we talk the unexpected pleasures of growing older. You're also writing about the handicap that a person could get when they're younger, becoming blind, losing an arm, ending up in a wheelchair, and finding and people talk about this, finding the pleasure in the ability to be able to still be alive, to do those other things. Again, it's back to memento mori, right?
Yes, but also figuring out how to live a good life. And everybody has the cards that they're dealt, right? And life isn't particularly fair, but you have what you have. Eric Erickson said, you know, these are your one and only parents and that you are dealt with or that you have, and then it's your one and only life. So how are you going to live it, and how are you going to live it as well as you can? Whether your body disappoints you or your life circumstances disappoint you, it's what you've got, so you're going to live it.
I was struck, Wendy Lesbauer, by your examples. You're talking about people in their 50s, in their 40s, but also people in their 80s and 90s and somebody who was 100 and something. So is it the unexpected pleasures of growing older, or is it the unexpected pleasures of acceptance? Or do they have to go, you know, hand in hand?
Yeah, I think that acceptance is part of it. And but you do need the passage of time, so it is related to getting older.
The reflection on seeing what matters.
Yeah, well, because we sort of have to live the questions of life. It's not a cerebral process, figuring out who you are, how to live. And so it's really about growing. And I mean that I use the term growing old, but if we don't even think about the word growing in that phrase, we're just so used to it. But I'm talking about growing into who one becomes and the burgeoning self that results.
Tell me about your mother and this story that you have towards the end of your book about your mother. You say that you describe a person who was a different person you're describing who never listened to other people, but always would overwhelm that other person with their own woes, their own problems, their own issues. But then, and your mother, you say your mother was afflicted with this burden as well. She regularly ran over other people's feelings with the weight of her own misery and anger.
Yes.
But she changed.
Yes.
How did she change?
See, I brought her into the book because I realized I, at close hand, had an example of someone who went on the detour of self-centeredness. And that's another way where your life doesn't get better if you're completely caught up in yourself. And my mother carried that as a huge burden. And what was so amazing was when she was in her early 70s, which I consider very young now, you know, she was by herself. Her second husband had died. She was living in a elder community with hundreds of women and like three men. And she had kind of given up on trying to find another companion. And she met very recently widowed man who was just completely grief-stricken. And he was being besieged by women who were hitting on him. And she said to him after about 6 months, "You know, why don't you come to this dance and meet people and get out of being so alone, and I'll introduce you to people," I think.
And also feeling besieged by people's desires.
Yes, yes. And what was so interesting is my mother had a massive crush on the guy and was keeping it secret because she didn't want to oppress him. And what is so amazing is she went to this dance with him, and now the story, I get it from this man himself. He told me that they arrived at the dance, and she introduced him to other people, and then he said, well, can I have a pleasure of a dance with you? And she said, no, I think you should just get out there. You already know me. Go out there and find somebody for yourself. And about 10 minutes later, my mother began having a stroke. And Mel held her in his arms as the ambulance came. And my mother died a couple of days later. So it was amazing when I met with this man who described the last active day of her life. He said that she died being a mensch, which means, you know, a really good human being. And that my mother came to a position of generosity in the last part of her life was so moving to me. And that's why I've included it in the book, because I think even self-centered people who have been stuck in that can grow and can come to this kind of discovery.
Wendy Lustbutter's book is Life Gets Better, The Unexpected Pleasure of Growing Older. Thank you.
Thank you.
A conversation with the Interfaith Amigos in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Robert Randolph first played the pedal steel guitar in church, the sacred steel.
You always wanted to be the pedal steel guy because, you know, you were the main rock star.
Now he's a rock star still playing pedal steel. I'm David Green. The sacred steel plus some soul and R&B on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m. 70 degrees now in Seattle, working our way up to 81 this afternoon, and the forecast calls for sun all day. Overnight, a clear sky, a low of 58, and tomorrow, Tuesday, sunny again, breezy as well, with a high of 87. 1043, I'm Bernard Ouellette. A judge who presided over most of the litigation related to the September 11th terrorist attacks will decide whether the owners of the World Trade Center can try to make airlines pay billions of dollars in damages. The trial begins today. We'll have more on that in 30 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. It's been more than a decade since Imam Jamal Rahman, Rabbi Ted Falconer, and Pastor Don McKenzie first sat down together for a conversation about faith and the world around them. That first conversation built into a friendship over the years and to an ongoing series of conversations about life, politics, religion, faith. Jamal Rahman, Ted Falconer, and Don McKenzie, the three interfaith amigos, as they're called now, are with us live in the studio today. Not always the case. Thanks, all three of you, for coming in.
Yeah, good morning.
Delighted to be here.
When I actually read that you had been together for more than a decade, it got me to thinking, before we move on to topics of heavy import, to have you recap again how it was that you came together. Because if I do the math, I'm thinking 2001. Am I right about
right.
that?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So Ted Falcon, do you want to recount the story of your coming together that first time?
I actually knew Jamal we were both in a board of a group that was trying to start a spiritual university. The spiritual university never happened, but when 9/11 happened, he was the first person I called because it was so clear that people had to see a different face of Islam. And the first time we worked together was that Shabbat, the Friday night of the 9/11 week. And we had such a good time appreciating each other's teaching that we started working together regularly.
So we became good friends, myself and Rabbi Ted Falcon. And, you know, being friends is probably the secret to interfaith dialogue, that heart-to-heart connection. Subsequently, Pastor Don McKenzie joined us, and we were doing all kinds of interfaith programs. And I like to say, I very soon realized that Rabbi Ted and Pastor Don were two of the best Muslims I know.
Started a conversation, I can guarantee you.
Well, why did you say that? What did you mean by that?
You see, the word Muslim actually means one who is surrendered to God. And what is a person surrendering? The attachment to the ego. So one can bring a heart turned in devotion to God. So I and Brother Ted did a lot of interfaith programs, and We realize we're from this, we're cousins. We're from the Abrahamic family. But of course, it's a very dysfunctional Abrahamic family. And our third cousin was missing. And that's where Pastor Don McKenzie comes in.
And Don McKenzie, did you know Ted and Jamal?
I knew Ted from the Jewish Christian Dialogue here in Seattle. And I had seen Jamal's picture in Yes magazine, so I knew he was a good guy.
And so did they approach you or did you approach them?
Ted called me and about 6 months after 9/11 and said that he and Jamal and some others were planning an event to mark the first anniversary, and would I like to be a part of it? Could it be at my church, University Congregational, United Church of Christ, here in Seattle? And I said yes, and we did it. And afterward, when we were debriefing, the three of us said, we can't stop now. Not having a clue what that meant, except we, I think, had an intuition that if we could penetrate the barriers that have traditionally separated our traditions, something cooperative and helpful could result. And so we started to meet weekly. We had we committed ourselves to really regular meetings to get to know each other and so forth. We had a radio show on an AM station for a year weekly. We've been to the Middle East a couple times, and then subsequently our books came out. We were in the New York Times, and we've been on the road. We've done presentations probably 180 times since that first book came out.
Now, Ted Falcon, when Jamal Rahman talked about how you are the best Muslims I know, and you said that provoked conversation, what did you mean by that?
Well, there's a couple things. You know, I mean, look, when you enter into deep conversation, there's always going to be things that will come up that will spur further conversation. One of them was we're the best Muslims. The other was that Abraham, there's a statement in the Quran that says Abraham was not a Jew, was not a Christian, but was the very first Muslim. And again, what's meant is Muslim in a larger sense, but we Jews claim Abraham, the Christians claim Abraham, and the Muslims claim Abraham. So all of it led to deeper dialogue. Sometimes when we get into arguments, Pastor Don will say that's money in the bank because it leads us to deeper conversations about what separates us and what unites us.
Did you have a set of ground rules beginning these conversations, or did they develop?
I think we could talk about those five steps of interfaith dialogue. They're very useful.
Right. Our whole relationship has become something that none of us could have imagined. Like, had we set out to do this, it would not have worked.
Right.
It's kind of unfolded over the years. And what we discovered along the way, five specific stages of effective interfaith dialogue. Because our initial question was, how come the interfaith dialogue hasn't worked to avoid demonizing the other? And the first step we discovered is not to get together and talk about your similarities, not to get together and talk about your differences, but to get together and create a context in which we can learn about each other as human beings. We don't have to be experts on our tradition. We have to be experts on ourselves. So there's questions that help people share their story. And that becomes the first step. And the second step is looking into what we consider to be the core teaching of each of our traditions.
The third step, based on that second step of the core teachings, and in the context of getting to know the other, is an invitation we feel to look at those core teachings and look at verses and practices in our traditions that are consistent with those core teachings, as well as verses and practices that are inconsistent with those core teachings.
And the fourth step, and this is only possible if the other three steps have been completed, is the willingness to be vulnerable and to be able to enter into more difficult conversations. For example, the Arab-Israeli conflict. As we have traveled over the country, we have seen and talked to many groups, Abrahamic faith, Jews, Christians, Muslims, but the moment the conflict of Israel-Palestine comes up, they break apart. Now, very frankly, I and Brother Ted, I shall say politely, we've had very, very vigorous conversations, and sometimes Pastor Don McKenzie had to mediate. But because we are friends on a personal level, the discussion continues. The fifth stage is, again, the willingness to not only celebrate other faith traditions, but sometimes also to really incorporate some of the insights and practices into our own traditions. That's why we say interfaith is not about conversion. It's about completion, becoming a more developed, complete human being.
We're talking with the three interfaith amigos, Jamal Rahman, Ted Falcon, Don McKenzie. And I have to, as you're speaking, I have to take you maybe in a little bit different direction, which is the George Zimmerman verdict over the weekend and increased cries out for better understanding between races, which must have parallels to better understandings between religious groups. And so we spoke with Jerry Large of the Seattle Times earlier today, and he talked about how we needed these conversations to begin on multiple platforms. Can you take your five steps and apply them to conversations about race?
We believe we can, not only with conversations about race, but with political conversations too, where the polarization is just so complete, it's hard for people to talk to each other. And we demonize the other. We don't appreciate each other as human beings who basically want good things.
Well, so in terms of providing a context, step one, come together as opposed to with this set idea of, you know, I'm going to talk about my religion, you're going to talk about yours. Are there things that work better than others in creating that, or at least a climate for that first step?
Well, we've discovered some questions that can be made available to people to ask so that listening becomes a higher skill for people and that things end up in a place where each can say, that person has a better sense of who I am. Sometimes that can happen from a deep place. Sometimes that could happen from a trivial place, like knowing the same song and liking it, you know, and that can eclipse all kinds of things.
The questions are available on our website, interfaithamigos.com. At the lower right hand of the first page is a link to the questions.
Ted Falcon's visualizing, so he knew where to tell you where the link was. Well, yeah. Jamal, I'd like to expand on that because I'm thinking about the case of a Seattle teacher at the Center School High School who had tried in a classroom to launch a series of frank conversations about race and wandered into some murky territory. So it sounds as if the location of these conversations is as important as that first question?
I think more important, the most important thing is really to be very humble and sincere about it, not to have a script, but to use our creativity, our persistence in really creating the environment where it is possible to connect on a human level. And this will vary with every different circumstance. Simple but not easy. Sometimes it can take a long time to have a connection of trust to be built. But with persistence, with creativity, we found it is possible.
So it's one thing to approach. Ted and Jamal knew each other as friendly acquaintances. I think it's deeper now at this point. But and then Don came in. So you three are friends. What about when politicians, for example, if we're talking about Palestine and Israel or Northern Ireland and Great Britain or any place in the world, you could just pick them. Politicians don't necessarily come to the table with that same intent, do they?
What we found, like we were at a dialogue a couple of years ago at Camp Brotherhood, now called Cascadian Center, in outside of Arlington, an interfaith retreat center. And they brought together representatives of libertarian, Tea Party, progressive arms. But instead of asking them to start talking about politics, they asked them to start talking about what helped shape their views. What in their history? What in their life?
Personal stories.
Absolutely. And it changed the whole thing. We were anxious to get into a smaller dialogue with the Tea Party person because we thought, and lo and behold, she was a human being, and she responded to us as human beings, and it's like opens your eyes. The conflicts between the demonstrators, it can't be solved on that level because it's a win-lose, and whenever it's a win-lose, it's a lose-lose. It has to be, who are you?
Right.
What are your needs? What do you see? What do you perceive?
So even the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, some of the best progress was made during the personal conversations in a house where they got to know one another, all the actors in Oslo. And, you know, they played with children, they got to meet the family members. And in that context, in that environment, it was possible to reach deeper.
So, Don McKenzie, what's the biggest barrier for us to do that? Because it sounds easy when you guys talk about it.
Well, it's what we call ego, or the little self, you know. We're not speaking clinically necessarily, but the part of us that needs to be protected, that wants power and so forth, and that needs to open. And that's a big part of our ministry, I would say. Our work is to try to help people to open up to the lives and so forth of other people. And one of the ways that we found is so important is for people to be able to hear the stories of other people, the things that give their lives purpose and meaning. Some would call that a spiritual path. The things that make sense and why. Where is the intersection there?
One of the things we do is when we go around in small groups and people are responding to a question, nobody responds to the same question. So when you're listening to another person, you're not thinking about what you're going to say about it because you don't even know your question until you turn over your card or it's read to you. And it encourages a deeper kind of listening.
And I think what is critical is for the three of us, we don't just get together and think of different steps we need to come up with. We do spiritual direction between ourselves. So we know unless we do the inner work of transforming our ego, opening up our heart, none of this is possible.
Imam Jamal Rahman, Rabbi Ted Falcon, Pastor Don McKenzie are the three interfaith amigos. And at this point, only Jamal has an official ministry. The other two are working on their interfaith dialogue.
And we have unofficial ministry.
Unofficial ministry.
Full-time jobs with interfaith amigos.
Thank you, the three of you, for coming in. Really nice to see all of you.
Good to see you, Marcy. So thank you.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, two conversations with two people who want to be mayor of Seattle. It starts at 9 o'clock on weekday. Hope you can join us.
A university here in Washington State has decided to offer an online degree in cybersecurity. KUOW's Lisa Brooks has more on that in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Bedrooms and More, family-owned in Wallingford on Northeast 45th Street for over 30 years, offering consumer education seminars on selecting a mattress, 9:30 Saturday mornings. Information online at howtoshopforamattress.com.
Have you ever had to deal with a difficult, noisy neighbor, but you didn't want to call the police? Well, maybe what they're doing isn't exactly illegal, but man, it's really bugging you. Well, there's another way to settle the dispute. Mediation. We're going to learn all about conflict resolution through mediation today during the noon hour on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from King County and Snohomish.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.